Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well.
So am I.
I'm doing very well. You know one of the reasons I'm doing well?
Why is that?
Because there are a broad array of foods that I eat over in time. And even throughout a day, there are just so many different varieties of food that I get to eat.
Gee, Mark, we're all happy for you. We live in America. What are you talking about?
I'm looking at, in Gourmet Magazine, there is just a little snippets, food facts. And one of the food facts is, 1 in 5 Americans live on a diet of 10 foods or fewer.
Yeah. My niece just eats chicken. That's it. That's fewer.
My 4-year-old eats more than 10 foods, so yeah. I don't know if this counts. But some of the most common choices?
No, this is scary. Hold on a second. In case you're scared that people survive on a diet of 10 foods or fewer in the most wonderful food market the world has ever
right.
seen.
Right, are one of the foods that they eat only quinoa, the miracle grain of the Andes, a complete protein from, is that one of those?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
According to this article in Gourmet Magazine, 1 in 5 Americans live on a diet of 10 foods or fewer, but among the most common choices of people who have only 10 things in their diet, they have things like French fries, fried chicken, chocolate chip cookies, and Kraft macaroni and cheese.
Can I tell you something?
Invest in Kraft?
No. Can I tell you something, really?
What?
If I had to be limited to only 10 foods in the world,
chocolate chip cookies would be
one of them would be chocolate chip cookies.
Yeah, but you're not limited to 10 foods.
And I can also tell you that French fries might be a second one.
But no wonder you're fat. Not you. I mean, everybody in general. America.
It really is no wonder I'm fat with all the food I
eat.
I meant
no wonder we're fat. I'm fat, too. But I do eat more than 10 foods.
Almost always. The other thing is that the average American eats 3 bottles of ketchup a year.
Yeah. You know what?
That seems like a lot of ketchup, doesn't it?
Not to me. I eat 5 bottles of ketchup. I'm sure that I'm above the average on that. I remember I was traveling in Portugal when I was a young man. And I'm traveling with my friend in Portugal and Spain, my friend Kurt. And we've been gone for a couple of months. And we found this. There's a large Canadian presence in this town in Portugal called Cascais, which is right on the water. And no, it wasn't in Cascais; it was in Lagos. Anyway, no one cares, of course. But
that matters that very important. Not in Cascais; it was in Lagos. Okay, well, everyone got that. Is that are we clear? That Francis was in Lagos.
We were in Lagos, and we found a Canadian bar, and the Canadian bar served hamburgers. And we're like, very cool. And so we'd order hamburgers, and I use about a quarter bottle of ketchup per burger. And
quarter bottle of ketchup per
burger. I use a lot. You've seen meat burgers.
Yeah, I have. And it's a disgusting sight to behold.
The barmaid came over and said, so we had to order more sauce Americaine for you. Okay, well, whatever. Charge
sauce
me extra.
Americaine. What is it, do you think, about ketchup that we love so much?
And it's got to be Heinz. I'm sorry you don't hear me talk about in favor of Big Fast. Well, unless you make it yourself, it's
got to
be Heinz.
I recently read a study of a taste test of all the ketchups, including the gourmet ketchups and the organic ketchups and the whole deal, and in the category of non-organic, Heinz was named the number one ketchup, and in the category of organic, Heinz Organic was named the number one, and Heinz Organic only slightly edged regular Heinz for the best overall. I mean, they really have the formula there at Heinz.
Well, you know what it is for me? It's got a lot of vinegar in it, so it's got that sour. It's
got
very sweet.
Salty,
it's very sour. It's
sweet,
the whole shebang.
Sour. It's all there.
Hunt's just doesn't cut it. Too sweet.
Hunt's, I can't do Hunt's. I would rather eat something plain than have it with Hunt's.
Okay, you ready for more fun facts from Gourmet Magazine this week?
We're done talking about ketchup?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
More fun facts.
Gourmet Magazine's a monthly magazine, by the way, not a weekly magazine,
right.
Just in case you're wondering.
All right. they put down that people will eat 28.4% more candy.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the show a little bit before.
They will eat 28.4% more candy if it's labeled low fat.
Okay, let me help everybody with just some with labeling and how people are getting over on you, okay, when they label stuff like this. If you eat pure sugar, it is low fat.
Right.
It is not good for you. You shouldn't eat more of something because it says low fat. And you know what? Alaskan wild salmon has lots of fat. And it's really, really good for you. So beware of the labels that people are putting. People will put anything on a label to make you buy more of it.
But
they will do anything, any little gimmick that anybody can bring to you to make you pay more for something or to make you buy more of it or eat more of it, they will do.
You know, the other thing is, if you're labeling something low fat, let's say they take 20% of the fat out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you eat 28% more of it. You're better off eating the full fat version.
You have failed. Yeah. You have failed in your... Speaking of gimmicks, though, I see another piece of paper in front of you.
Well, this I got to talk about. Have you seen this? Trump Steaks, Donald Trump, that really nice guy, Donald Trump? No.
He's a good American.
Oh, please. Donald Trump is now behind a line of steaks, and his steaks are the best steaks available. No, they're not.
Okay? Oh, I saw you had this up on your monitor the other day. He actually does a commercial for this. You can actually click on the commercial and listen to the infomercial that he does about his steaks.
Yeah, he talks about how they're what are they, prime?
They're prime steaks.
The prime steaks.
Top 1% of steaks.
And they're certified Angus. And that's true. Those prime and Angus are great.
Can I just tell you, he's up on your monitor, and I'm sitting across the room from Francis, and all I hear is, these are the best steaks. You're going to love these steaks. You can't get a steak like this anyplace else. I was like, who is that voice? And it was the Donald.
Well, and it's from the show, you know, and because he says that he thinks it's true, and listen, here's what I love. People love to pay more money,
mm-hmm.
okay? And here's the deal. You can buy them available only through the Sharper Image. I'm thinking, how's the Sharper Image get you great quality steaks?
They can't. How do they keep great quality steaks fresh?
Because
they're the Sharper Image. They're not a food store. They don't have...
Okay.
They're not set up to give you... You know, high quality, fresh ingredients.
But they could be shipping, you know, fresh steaks.
I don't. Okay, maybe they could be, but
they're not. They're frozen steaks.
Awesome.
They're frozen steaks. Now, whatever the quality was before they froze it, they then made frozen steaks. Okay. And are you ready for this? You can get free home delivery. You can get the Metro Collection, for example, which is roughly 38 ounces of beef
mm-hmm.
for $99.
That's awesome.
$99 for 3 pounds of steak. That's $33 a pound for frozen steaks.
Right.
What this is a lesson in is not steaks, but how Donald Trump got rich.
Here's what I'm going to tell you. In my restaurant, Stage Left, we serve you 3 pounds of steak for $99, except we cooked it. We serve the accoutrements with it. It comes out on a beautiful tablecloth.
And we clear it away.
Someone brings it to you. We clear it when it's done. And we ask you if you'd like another glass of wine with that.
So here's the deal. Believe Donald Trump or me, frozen steaks, not as good as my
steaks. Well, that's the idea.
And our steaks, okay. And our steaks are never frozen.
Okay. When you freeze, and this is a gimmick that a lot of these steakhouses that ship to you will do, they freeze your meat. And it will never be as good as an unfrozen piece same quality.
And look, it's just that we care so much about this stuff that I hate to see people hoodwinked. And there are really great steaks out there. And there are really great steaks out there that are not frozen that you can get for less than $33 a pound. And that's what we encourage you to do. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, Stage Left in Captain LaGuardia Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Today we're talking with Jeff Roberts. He helped establish the Vermont Institute for Artisan Cheese at the University of Vermont. He's national director with Slow Food USA and co-chaired Artisan Cheeses of America. He lives in Vermont, and he joins today to discuss his wonderful book, The Atlas of American Cheese.
Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Francis and Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Jeff, 20 years ago, the Atlas of American Cheese would have been slightly smaller than your Atlas today.
Yeah, it would be more like a pamphlet.
I mean, I remember back, you know, working in other restaurants and when we first started our restaurant. I mean, if you had Mountain Shepherd on your cheese board and Maytag Blue, you were just at cutting edge, top of the top. You couldn't do any better.
That's probably very true. And if you had any goat cheese, people thought you were crazy.
Well, and if you were a cheesehead, and we were cheeseheads early on in so many ways, Jeff, but in the restaurant as well, we had mostly 20 years ago French and Italian cheeses on
our board. Right.
How many American producers do you list in the Atlas of American Cheese?
Well, there are 345 full descriptions and profiles of producers out of, approximately 400 that I identified.
No, we're not talking, and that excludes, you know, craft dairies. We're talking
about,
you know, artisanal cheese producers, little guys making cheese on the farm kind of thing.
Well, there are a handful of larger companies, and they're included because they, in fact, do make some cheese by hand. Cabot's a very good example.
I think Cabot is a great example of that.
You know, here's a company that has been around since the 1920s, and while they moved into industrial or commodity production, they always made their traditional 38-pound wheels, the ones that you might remember you'd see in the general stores sitting on the Cracker Barrel.
Mm-hmm.
That was still made by hand.
I don't actually remember that, Jeff, just so you know.
Well, you have to come to New England. We still have a handful of places like that. But that was something that they continued to do. And then a couple of years ago, they established a relationship with Jasper Hill Farm here in Vermont to begin trying to do something just a little bit different using that same size wheel, but sourcing the milk from only one farm using a different blend of cultures.
Which is pretty amazing for that a large, I don't want to say industrial corporation because they're not that, but certainly they're producing a ton of cheese. So it's pretty amazing that there's even an interest in that for a company the size of Cabot.
Well, I think a couple of things are apparent, and this is in a way relates to some of the questions you were asking a moment ago. The cheese landscape in America has changed dramatically, and larger companies, not yet Kraft, but larger companies like Cabot are paying attention to what consumers are asking for. And that, I think, is what allows them to go into this joint project with Jasper Hill to create a cheese which won the Best in Show last year at the American Cheese Society.
Cabot's making some pretty darn good cheeses.
Oh, yeah. And they're a very, very good producer of commodity cheese.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there are a number of good commodity producers, but it's a different way of approaching food and agriculture.
Well, I just want to point out that, you know, and I like to give our audience credit whenever we can. Look, we're here on the radio. You know, this is our avocation, you know. In our restaurant, we're able to do this. You have this as a vocation as well. But when it comes right down to it, what moves the market? We can't do this. These cheese producers can't do this. If you out there don't have great taste, and if you don't start saying, hey, where does my cheese come from? What's this cheese like? I'm willing to look at flavors I haven't tasted before and aromas I haven't tasted before and looking for new small cheeses. So, you know, Cabot is responding, as Jeff said, to your increasingly good taste. And that's keeping farmers on the farm. That's keeping artisanship alive in America. And it's keeping me in my job. Thank you.
Can we talk?
I could not agree with you more. That is the place of consumers when it comes to the future of agriculture and food in this country. Most of us don't realize that every time we make a choice, it has an implication or a ripple effect way back down the line. And so every time we buy cheese from a local cheese seller, we're buying something from New Jersey, for example, that money stays in New Jersey. And that, to me, is important. It doesn't go to China, for example.
Well, and it also stays supporting some, you know, small dairy operation that's making some artisanal cheeses. If we don't have people out there with good taste like you all in the listening audience, then, you know, Kraft singles are fine for everybody, and the small farmer isn't on the farm anymore.
That's right.
You know, you have 345 producers out of 400 that you were able to identify in America, and that's just in America, who are making artisanal cheese like this. 20 years ago, what do you think the number would have been?
Well, I can tell you that in 2000, half of the 345 did not exist.
That's amazing. And that speaks to what a heck of a growth that is, and it's just it's a real celebration. I remember another thing that when we changed, that is still sort of the case, when you buy American cheeses, they cost a little more. Actually, with the euro going up, they're sort of balancing out.
And we're not talking about Land O'Lakes here.
Yeah, yeah, but these American cheeses from these small dairies, they cost a little bit more, but I think they're worth it. Do you think they're still costing a little bit more?
Yes, and it depends on where you are. New York City, you can get $30 to $35 a pound. I won't pay that in Vermont, and a lot of my fellow Vermonters won't pay it. But then what I encourage people to do is you don't have to buy a pound to enjoy it. You can buy 5 ounces and have a great cheese on your table. What I think is changing is that people realize that the issue isn't just price. They can get great flavors by buying local cheese, but it also helps support broader social goals.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are concerned about where does our food come from, and this is not a statement against, let's say, the Europeans, a lot more people are asking, did this come from New Jersey or Vermont or Connecticut?
You know, that's a great issue, and we're going to talk about that. And specifically, I want to talk about New Jersey cheese in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:26.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi. We're talking with Jeff Roberts. He is the author of The Atlas of American Artisan Cheese. You, in your wonderful book here, Survey American Cheeses Overall, there are a lot of cheeses produced in our own home state of New Jersey. It's sort of a unique case, isn't it, Jeff?
I think so. I think it's a wonderful case. You have, on the one hand, some historic dairies like Fiore's in Hoboken or Vito's New Deli that's also in Hoboken.
They make fresh mozzarella too, on it.
Yeah, I think people don't look at Fiore's or Vito's and necessarily think of them as a cheese producer. They think, you know, it's kind of a deli, it's kind of a little shop. And when you look at a place like that, that's not necessarily your first inclination that they're producing cheese.
Hey, I just want to point out, Fiore's is a place I go all the time. I live in Jersey City, New Jersey. They're in Hoboken, New Jersey. Cash only, so don't bring your credit card because it ain't going to fly. Owned by the same family for 60 years. The owners are back there making the mozzarella to order all the time. And I think it's great and wonderful that they've made it into the American cheese atlas that you've written, because we think of them as a local treasure, but I mean they're you know, of a national scale of quality.
Absolutely.
And you can walk in there any day of the week except for Sundays, because they're closed on Sundays, of course, and you can get a sandwich made with this fresh mozzarella, or you can get a piece of fresh mozzarella. Absolutely amazing. Hey, listen, we're going to go and listen to the news, but when we come back, I want to talk more about New Jersey and about America in general and the wonderful cheeses that you can find out there. And this book is the best resource that I've ever seen for you, our listeners, to be able to find cheeses. You can find out more about it on our website. We'll be back in a moment talking with the author, Jeff Roberts, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and half of Lombardi Restaurants in Charleston, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Jeff Roberts about his wonderful book. It's a tremendous resource if you're interested in cheese at all. It's the Atlas of American Artisan Cheese. You can find out about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com.
So, Jeff, we were talking just a moment ago about New Jersey dairies. We talked about places that we didn't think are necessary traditional dairies like Fiori's and Vito's. But tell us about some of the other dairies in New Jersey that we have available to us.
Well, you have two, in my opinion, two of the most unique and important producers for very different reasons. One is Bobolink. Jonathan White and his wife, Nina, who were working with rare breeds of cows, which...
And this is a relatively new dairy, right?
Yes. Jonathan and Nina used to have their dairy was called the Peekskill Dairy and Egg Farm up along the Hudson Valley.
Right, Egg Farm Dairy.
And then they moved to Jersey, and they reopened 4 or 5 years ago. His approach to cheesemaking... I like to think of Jonathan as one of these wonderfully creative iconoclasts. He wants to find something unique. They've done this in part because of the animals that they're raising. And then second, they've built a cave where they're able to age their products in a way that is unique to the place. You're not going to duplicate this around the next hill or over around the next corner. That's important. And the other guys are the folks over at Valley Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
And here's one of our older sheep dairies. There are not very many sheep dairies in the United States. And what these folks have done, Aaron and Deborah Waswold, is create, again, another very unique set of cheeses, all built around sheep's milk. I can't find them in Vermont. They're cheeses that if I could, I'd be buying all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Very important. And they've also, in a sense, created a business in a place where you don't necessarily think about cow dairies, let alone a sheep dairy. So I think they're also important. I'd like to say one more thing about the place of Fiori's and Vito.
Yeah.
What I discovered... as I started doing the research for the book, is that there are delicatessens like Fiori's. The Fiori's goes back a long way.
1913.
And there, I'd like to say something more about Vito and Fiori, because they represent, as you were saying a little bit earlier, they represent something about artisan cheese which most of us don't pay any attention to. If you look at the cover of the Atlas, this wonderful photograph of beautiful goat cheese. That's what we have today as our image of handmade cheese. But Italian Americans, Portuguese Americans, Hispanic Americans not only brought cheese traditions with them, but they're still doing this.
Mm-hmm.
They're still making that mozzarella by hand in the back room.
We at Catherine Lombardi Restaurant, we make your fresh mozzarella. When you order it, at that time it comes out a little bit warm and still kind of amorphous. And being able to do that, is extraordinary. And having when you get to taste something like that, there's nothing like it.
And especially as you just described it, where it has not been refrigerated at all, because just a little bit of cold changes the texture of that cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now let's talk about is Fiori's in your book because it's the best of category, or it's an example of a lot of places?
Some of each.
Uh-huh.
I'll be honest with you. The connection. I did not remember Fiori's until I was talking with a woman named Lourdes Fiore Smith, who is the granddaughter of the Fiore who had the business in the 1950s. She lives outside of Boston and recently started making mozzarella just the way her grandfather did, and her mother is her quality control expert. It's just great. And she started telling me about the deli, and I said, well, I know this delicatessen. This is Frank Sinatra's delicatessen.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly
right. Absolutely right. So as I started to peel this back a little bit more, I realized I could have done a book just on Italian, Portuguese, and Hispanic delis where they're still making cheese by hand.
You know, I'll tell you something that happened to me when I walk into Fiore's, and I think it relates to the rest of your book and a lot of what we're talking about in a sense of community. I live up in Jersey City, but I've known about Fiore's since, I was 22, because I'm from North Jersey in general, but I wasn't as close. I was in Essex County. So now that I live near there, I go every, I'd say once or twice a month I'm in Fiore's. I'm buying some mozzarella. You know, and it's not cheap, okay? But you have to get it fresh because mozzarella, and if you haven't had fresh mozzarella and you're listening out there, you haven't had mozzarella. Because once you refrigerate it, as you said, Jeff, the curds seize up and it's a different texture. It's that plasticky thing. It's that plasticky thing that we get in the supermarket. It's not the same as what you get fresh. I was in Fiore's and I was getting my fresh mozzarella. And if you store it overnight, the way I started home is I leave it out on the counter in some salt water, and it's fine for a couple of days. And I'd forgotten my wallet. And I know they don't take credit cards. And I said to the guy, hey, listen, I forgot my wallet. Hold the order, because he's cut it and got it. I mean, he's got about $75 worth of stuff, right? I said, hold the order. I'll go home. I'll get my. I forgot my cash. I had a credit card, right? I had my wallet with me, but I didn't have the cash in my pocket. And he says, no, don't worry about it. Get me next time. Now, he doesn't know me that well, but that's what he said. He said, go ahead, don't worry about it. Get me next time. And, of course, I went back the next week with $75, and I said, hey, I owe you that $75. He's like, oh, yeah, okay, great, thanks. Now, I'm not suggesting you try this. I may have just done a great disservice sending people up there. But, when the nice thing about this book, you have pictures of these folks with their animals on their farms. It's very different than an industrial cheese production. These people just seem nice.
Well, thank you. I wrote this book for a number of reasons, the first one of which is that I'm very selfish about where my food comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of these cheesemakers. I've gotten to know a lot more over the last year as I worked on this book. They're among the most amazing group of people anywhere in the country. And, in a time when there's so much that we are concerned about locally, nationally, internationally, what this book tells me is that there's a lot of good reason to be optimistic about good people. And it's as much a celebration of the people as it is about taste, about commitment to hard work, about very basic, what I would say, very basic American values. And it's not what I set out to do. There's another book I have in mind, if my wife will let me write it.
That's funny, I have another restaurant in mind, if my wife will let me open.
Your wife will let you do it. And so I didn't do a lot of interpretation and analysis. I wanted to use the book to tell stories. And someone on the West Coast who's just done a review said what she came away with was this is a cultural and historical snapshot of a piece of American agriculture that gives her great reason to be optimistic.
Wow.
I couldn't have said it any better than that.
Wow. That's great.
Well, and I want to point out, because, I'd like people to buy your book as well, because I think, it's to all of our benefit when people understand more about where their food comes from. It's a wonderful and pretty book, but it's also extremely useful.
When you talk about a resource, you give the resources here, the phone numbers are here, the addresses are here, the websites are here, whether or not they have a place you can visit. I mean, it's almost a travel guide for the dairies of the cheese dairies of the country.
And you read about these all the time in these specialty magazines, but then you don't know how to get your hands on it. Mm-hmm. And very often, if you know how to go to the source, you can figure out how to get the cheese. When we come back, I want to leave this as a cliffhanger. We're going to come back after a break, and I want you to I want to share some stories about a woman named Douglas and her heard of long-eared Nubian goats. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on Nine is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightsonnine.com. That's lightsonthenumber9.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, on stage left in Capitol Party. Our guest today is Jeff Roberts. His wonderful book is The Atlas of American Artisan Cheese, which you can find out how to purchase on our website. I left as a teaser before the break, Jeff, a story about a woman named Douglas and her herd of long-eared Nubian goats. You want to tell us about Douglas Newbold?
Yes, I'm sorry that I didn't have a chance to meet her when I lived in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
She is among the earliest producers of goat cheese in this country. Before 1970, most people wouldn't know a chev if they tripped over it.
Right.
And the chefs that any of us knew were all coming from, principally from France. Her cheese was on the restaurant menu at the White Dog Cafe for years. And when I worked at the University of Pennsylvania, I know I ate this cheese many times. It wasn't until I tracked her down last year, and she said, well, I'm out of business, but let me tell you a little bit about my history. And I thought, this is really amazing. She introduced a group of Philadelphians who ate the White Dog to Chev.
Yeah.
She also got other people who knew about her success to consider making cheese. And there are a handful of these people in the beginning of the 1970s. There are a couple people on the East Coast. There are a couple people on the West Coast who, when it comes to goat cheese, in my opinion, really set a standard and created the opportunities for other prospective cheesemakers to take this on.
We had the
wonderful.
We had the great good fortune to have her goat cheese on our menu just one time. We were able to convince her to send us some goat cheese.
I'll tell you the funny story. I got in touch with Douglas Newbold when I had her cheese, and it was one of the best goat cheeses in America. Now, she was established in 1972. And I got in touch with Douglas Newbold, I'm going to say, in 96, right? And we'd opened in 92.
Right, and 96.
I spoke to her on the phone, and she was sort of surprised to hear from me. And I said, I'd like to buy some of your goat cheese. And she said, well, I don't have any. Everything I have is spoken for by restaurants. But, you know, you it's been very nice talking to you, and if I get any more goats, I'll give you a call. 2.5 years later, I get a call. Douglas Newbold is on the phone. I pick up the phone, and she said, I have some more goats online. Would you like some cheese? And so for a while, we were able to have this amazing cheese, but we got into a wonderful conversation with her, and she said, listen, I love my goats, and the cheese is the way that they can pay their way. And it was a fresh, clean, simple cheese that she said, the fastest and cleanest cheese that I could get to market. But this comes from a love of the animals. Is that a common thread that runs,
Absolutely.
At least to a certain extent, through all these producers?
Yeah. As you were talking, as you were getting towards the end of what you were just saying, I was sort of thinking of a number of people that I've met. One of them that comes to mind is a dairy in Idaho called Rolling Stone Chev. Husband and wife team, she makes the cheese, and Chuck is the herdsman. And I refer to him in the book as the goat whisperer because everyone says that his goats do things that nobody else can do. And there's this relationship that he has. When I've ever asked him about other kinds of goats, he says, oh, no, all I want are Sanin goats. That's it, period.
What does goats do? Do they type or play the piano? What exactly does he get out of
them? I don't know. In Idaho, I'm not sure. But now, they're fascinating animals. They're very intelligent. They eat very differently than a cow. And when you look at the sorts of goat cheeses that are being made today, the array of cheese is pretty extraordinary. We have learned to make absolutely stunning cheese that, in my opinion, can stand up to anything being produced in Europe.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
And that's world opinion. It agrees, of course, on that account. So the final chapter of the Douglas Newbold and her herd of long-eared Nubian goats that she's had since she was a teenager, does she still have the goats?
Yes, but she's not producing cheese.
Wow, that's...
She said that it just got to be too much, and that occasionally she'll still supply some to the white dog. But I debated over whether to keep her in the book because she's not actively in production.
No, you have to.
Yeah, she was an important part of the
exactly.
whole cheese culture in this country.
And so that's the reason why she's there.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing that I want to point out is with these artisanal cheeses, you can get some of the Green Market Union Square has two different producers that show their stuff there all mm-hmm. the time. They change with the seasons, as depending on what the goats eat or the cows eat or whatever it is.
Yep. And the cheeses taste differently. I just want to talk really briefly about raw milk cheeses. I know, Jeff, you're a strong proponent of raw milk cheeses. How do we get the United States government to change their tune a little
bit? To allow raw milk cheeses,
raw milk cheeses.
Well, I'm not sure I know the answer to that. Where I would like to start is what I want the government to do is to find something else that's more important to deal with than worry over whether eating aged raw milk cheese is a health problem. The evidence from CDC, from the Centers for Disease Control, basically show that our dairy products, whether it's industrial or artisan, are the safest in the world. And you can count on two hands the number of food outbreaks that are attributed to cheese at all.
Right.
None of it has to do with raw milk cheese. So my major concern has been to ensure that FDA doesn't make any changes at all in the current regulations. Unfortunately, I think that the tenor of food safety and public health is such in our country right now that the idea of allowing fresh and soft-ripened raw milk cheeses just isn't going to fly. And my concern is that if we start really pounding on this issue, we may put in jeopardy what we already are allowed mm-hmm. to do.
So, Jeff, there are some ways to get raw milk cheeses in this country that are still soft cheeses if you just have to wait a certain amount of time.
There are some cheeses that are being made that conform exactly to that rule.
Mm-hmm.
And are soft ripened.
Right.
They're truly remarkable.
We have to leave it there. We'll have you back again to talk about those, Jeff. It's been a pleasure, and your book's amazing.
Thank you very much. It's been a real enjoyable conversation with both of you. I look forward to seeing you in Jersey.
Come and see
We're
us.
We're here.
Central
Thanks,
Jersey,
Jeff.
Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:56. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guy, Mark and Friends. Talking about cheese today.
You know, one of the things we were talking about with Jeff was evolution of cheese in this country and how it's kind of changed. I remember taking a ski trip with my friends up to Vermont. It's got to be 92, 93, right when we first opened. And going to one of the Vermont cheese shops, and I remember I walked in and I was really into cheese, and the guy kind of picked up on the fact that I was really into cheese, and I was tasting a bunch of the Grafton cheddars.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you remember, because I actually brought some of these back to the restaurant.
I remember.
And I'm tasting some of the Grafton cheddars, and they had this beautiful three-year-age cheddar, and it was delicious, and it had this pungency to it and this sharpness to it, and I was intrigued by it. And I said, you know, I have this four-year cheddar. And I said, oh, okay, great. And I was even more intrigued by the four-year cheddar. And then he said, well, you know, we don't give this to a lot of people, but I have some five-year Grafton cheddar here under the counter.
I remember that cheese.
And I remember that. I was like, wow. I mean, it filled the room with aroma, and it filled my mouth with just this unbelievable bursting flavor. It was, I mean, it was very pungent and very sharp.
Too much for me.
And it was one of those cheeses that I want to eat half an ounce of.
Really, rarely have I thought, I'm not man enough to eat this cheese. But the Grafton five-year cheddar was...
brought it back to the restaurant, and we had to keep it separate from the other cheeses because it wouldn't play nice with the other cheeses. Everything tasted like Grafton five-year-old cheddar after its acquaintance with the Grafton cheddar.
I remember we sent a little bit of that home with one of our regular customers, and he brought it back because his wife wouldn't let him keep it in the refrigerator.
Yeah, so every once in a while you'll get a cheese on the cheese, you know, on our cheese board or in the restaurant that just is so powerful that it almost overtakes the other cheeses that you have around it. Make sure you eat that one last.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really important.
And if you leave that out on the counter, don't leave it on the counter during dinner. Move it away or cover it with glass.
I kind of call it the Swiss cheese effect. If you leave open Swiss cheese in a little drawer in your refrigerator,
everything tastes like Swiss cheese.
Ham tastes like Swiss cheese. Or salami tastes like Swiss cheese.
Words to live by.
And I do.
Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Scott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450.